From Dune.
By Frank Herbert. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it is gone, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. The journey into fear is easy. Faster than a snap, from something sensed to a body flooded with hormones and neurotransmitters, and we feel fear. Or those same hormones and neurotransmitters flood our bodies and we don't feel fear. Instead, we feel irritable, angry, depressed, anxious, apathetic. Because the truth is this. Most of us make the journey into fear every single day. And it feels so common, we don't even notice it anymore. If we turn the television on or the radio or open a paper or read the news on our phone, fearful things take us on the journey into fear, whether we recognize it or we don't. Fear resides in our amygdala, the oldest part of our brain. It is very small and almond-shaped and near the center, and it's often called the reptile brain. It is powerful and commanding. Long ago, when the shadow of a wing crossed the land or a branch snapped, fear rushed through an animal's tiny bodies, shutting down every unnecessary function. Hearts beat wildly, attention focused, and muscles tensed. They ran or froze or fought. And the fear and acting were immediate, or they were for the ones that survived. The amygdala sends tendrils of connection into the newer cognitive parts of our brain. And these are intended to have the amygdala turn off, actually, all those higher brain functions like reasoning, which take time to work, and turn on the parts of our brain necessary for survival, such as focused attention. At the very same time, the cognitive pathways of our brain have very few pathways back to the amygdala. And this makes it extremely difficult for the amygdala to calm down and with rational thought. So, for example, let's say you're walking down the street and you see something in the darkness and you get flooded with those fear hormones. You know, you're on edge, you're looking around, you're attentive, and you notice it's a cat. Well, notice how in your body it doesn't just go away. You're not just not afraid anymore. You're still tensed. You're still on edge. Everything's still aroused for a while. It takes time for that to go away. And our brain saying, hey, it was just a cat, isn't all that successful in making it go away. So besides calling our body into action, our amygdala actually sends messages into our hippocampus, which codes negative memories more easily than positive memories, actually. And it's particularly good at coding fear memories. And the reason is simple. If something really dangerous happens, it's good to have it well coded in memory so the next time something like that happens, you will know what to do or what not to do. And it's also the reason that it is easier for us to remember bad things than good ones, unfortunately. So fear is far, far more powerful to us than reason, says neurobiologist Michael Finslow. It evolved as a mechanism to protect us from life-threatening situations. And from an evolutionary standpoint, there's nothing more important than that. When a saber-toothed tiger is chasing you, fear makes your life possible. And in fact, when you think about it, every single one of us is here because of fear. Our ancestors, all those ancestors back for centuries and millennia, every one of them was saved at some point, probably because of a startle reflex or caution in a certain moment. I mean, there was a lot of luck, too. But fear definitely played a role and made our lives possible. But the truth is that sometimes fear doesn't come from saber-toothed tigers. Sometimes it comes from our culture, from stories told and retold, and from disturbing images and music. In fact, today, most of our amygdalas do not react to actual dangerous situations. We are hardly ever in life-threatening situations. But images and stories of danger, that's what we see. That's what we react to. So what we know, however, because of those images and those stories, that we all experience vicarious traumatization every day. And what is worse is to our brains, vicarious trauma is just like primary trauma. Human beings evolve to experience other people's experiences. And this makes complete sense evolutionarily. If someone tells the story of how they escaped a poisonous snake, it's good to really understand that and replay it. We also need to be able to experience compassion with one another, because that's how we create loving, bonded communities, which are essential for human survival. So in our brains, we each have mirror neurons that activate when we see somebody do something or see something happen to someone else. So if I turn off my iPhone and you watch me, in your brain, we'll fire the exact same pathways that are firing in mine when I actually do it, when you watch it. If you watch something bad happen to somebody, you will actually have those same things triggering in your brain that triggered in their brain when it was happening to them. So when we watch television or listen to the news or read about events that are violent or painful or severely challenging, our brain reacts as if we are actually experiencing it. And most of us, I certainly have and do, believe that something is protecting us from those images and sounds. The fact that we know they aren't happening to us rationally, we think that creates some sort of space, some kind of protection for us, that it doesn't impact us as much. But brain research shows that this actually is not true. The fear element in our brains activates when we witness violence and fearful images, as if we were there. Today, all forms of news and entertainment lead with fear, because the emotion is so powerful that it engages us fully. It grabs viewers. Since fear makes us act, politicians use fear to win votes. In fact, the political analysts and people who work on campaigns say that you can't, in fact, win a campaign unless you're using fear as a motivator. And so people on each side of the public issues, from abortion to food safety laws to international treaties, attempt to scare other people to get onto their side. When you consider that the average American watches 4.5 hours of television in each day, in addition to consuming information, stories, and images on the internet, in print, and on the radio, that a significant amount of that content heightens our individual fear responses. So consider that. Consider how often you hear or see scary, unpleasant, distressing events. These affect the flow of hormones and transmitters in your body. Many of us spend hours a day with fear hormones flowing through our bodies. And we know from experience how long they stay, just sort of setting us on edge. And in our cases, we don't run or freeze or fight. It would be completely inappropriate. We know those things aren't happening to us. But we may get angry. We could get frustrated or depressed or angry or anxious or apathetic. because those are all other secondary forms of fear response. We can really get worn down from all that makes us afraid. The worst fear mongering can come in campaign ads, which I'm sure you're somewhat aware of. I remember a few years back, I watched an ad whose entire purpose was to make people afraid of immigrants. I don't remember the words, but I remember the images and the music. There was children sleeping in a nice suburban home, and I watched a number of political ads, actually, the ones that are considered most fearful, looking for this ad that I remember, and there is almost always sweet children who will be hurt in them. So in this particular ad, the music was really eerie in a Halloween sort of way, and dark, hunched, faceless figures slunk across the American-Mexican border, and then somehow they were next to the house with the sleeping children. And I got the message, undocumented immigrants could hurt my kids. In 2018, politicians across the country ran ads that tried to create fear of those with dark skin, particularly immigrants. One ad that many deemed almost the most racist ad in history, an undocumented immigrant is shown in court after being convicted of killing two police officers. And he is grinning and laughing and saying if he ever gets out, he's going to kill more police. And this horrible image is juxtaposed against images of a caravan from Central America with hundreds of people who have similar skin heading north, seeking legal asylum in our country. And the words in the ad are, who else will the Democrats let in? It's if all people who want to come to the U.S. are murderers. I don't think these ads or others I watched influenced my perspective on immigrants or intensified any of my prejudices. I really do try to live our first principle on the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But somehow those dark-skinned people slinking across the screen to danger music is inside me. I remember it years later. The hippocampus has claimed it in me as one of the memories that I will keep. And that juxtaposing images of a crazy murderer with other dark-skinned people is in me as well. They are stuck in me, these fear images and these associations, because that's what fear does to us. Fear is one of the strongest emotions that we have, and it has significant power over how we understand the world. And I really don't know how those fearful images and sounds influence my decisions or, more importantly, my automatic responses to people, as most of that happens unconsciously in something social scientists call implicit bias. Research shows that most people in our culture, regardless of race, are more likely to see people with dark skin negatively than people with beige, or what we call white, skin. Centuries, decades, years of coding dark skin with dangerous imagery has taken its toll. Implicit bias is one of the ways that our brain works. Our brains use lots of shortcuts to understand and predict what is going to happen. It makes it more efficient as our brain works to interpret things that happen in our environment. One of the ways it does this is that it codes attitudes and stereotypes deep in our unconscious and uses those to interpret things that we see. Implicit bias is involuntary and it is unconscious. And it is universal. It is built over time through associations from all sorts of messages, from campaign ads to the way the bad guy hyenas in Disney's Lion Kings have black city accents. Implicit bias may even contradict what we cognitively believe to be true. So you may believe, as I do, that all people have inherent worth and dignity and that you don't have a racist bone in your body and still be slightly afraid when you walk past a group of black teens on a corner. You may even cross the street, which then impacts the teens as a microaggression. They notice We are people that other people are afraid of, which feels to me like a terrible, demeaning message to get as a teenage boy, that people are afraid of you. When our brain associates particular types of people with fear, all kinds of bad things can happen. For example, police officers are generally more afraid of black men than white men. They are more likely to see a gun that is not there on a black man than a white one. They are affected by implicit bias and fear, which they were given by their culture. Since the brain specializes in making up stories that predict and interpret based on its biases, the brain will actually create fictional guns and knives that the officer then uses to justify the killing. And I'm not saying that they really did see them. It's not like they made it up in the future. I mean, maybe some of them did, but it's been shown, actually, in experiments that people will do this, that they will misplace the gun or the knife in the black person's hand when the white person was actually holding it, or they will just make one up in experiments. And we do see it all the time in real-lived examples. Often police officers believe they saw a weapon on an unarmed black man. And then there's the huge debate in the media. Was it reasonable to think there was a weapon there or not, when it was a pack of cigarettes or something? Well, no, it actually was not reasonable. But fear is not reasonable. Fear can save us. Fear does save us. It has saved us. But fear also kills. Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." In our modern world, he's absolutely right. I believe that our greatest calling as Unitarian Universalists is hospitality. The welcoming of the other, exactly as they are. Our values speak broadly to hospitality, the inherent worth of each person, fairness in human relationships, our desire to be diverse and to honor different paths on the search for truth and meaning, recognizing different backgrounds and cultures, and different ways of being and expressing our humanness. Fear is one of the great barriers to hospitality. Consider the U.S.-Mexican border. We are told we need to exclude and be inhospitable to people fleeing intolerable violence and economic devastation because they are dangerous. They are criminals. They belong to gangs. They are drug dealers. They are murderers. The executive branch especially emphasizes murders by the undocumented when they discuss border danger. While this is utterly tragic and horrible when it has happened, it is, in fact, not a significant danger that anyone needs to worry about. It is, in fact, statistically more likely that you will be killed by a hot appliance in your kitchen or, get this, strangled by your pajamas. And I don't really want to add that to any of your list of things that you should be afraid of, but this is an actual cause of death in the United States. So fear is not reasonable when it comes to people at our border, but it is the official reason given for lack of hospitality to even those who have legal rights to our hospitality. And this is deplorable. But the sad truth of it is that any of us can become inhospitable when implicit bias mixes with fear. It can be much less obvious than the drama at the border. Perhaps our fear comes by not saying hi to someone who makes us nervous, or saying hi in a really tentative way, or watching them with some suspicion. People feel these things, and they feel unwelcome. Or we can even be more unwelcoming. I worked in a congregation briefly where a young man with cognitive disability approached the membership desk for assistance. They asked, misinterpreting his age, if he wanted to go to the high school group. And he said yes, and he was escorted there. And there was a policy at that time in that church that only children, youth, and teachers could ever be in the RE wing during class as a safety precaution. And the youth group had had a visitor that day, and the high school group leaders assumed that this young man was accompanying the visitor. But the visitor left, and the young man did not. And the leaders were suddenly afraid. Why was this young man here? What was he doing? What was his intent? They spoke sharply to him, asking him why he was there. The young man was inarticulate in his reply. One of the leaders took him aside and yelled at him for being where he should not be and for being perhaps dangerous. The man, known as a gentle and confused soul by others in the congregation, left in tears. For me, this is a hospitality horror story. So much went wrong for that young man, who definitely needed our love and our grace. He was different in a way that disturbed other people. He was actually pretty different. He had cognitive disabilities. So implicit bias filled in other people's brains. Stories of shootings, of sexual abuse, of assaults, all the fear we see and hear in the news that lives in bodies and in memories. All of the fear was there in that room with that strange young man who was not where he was supposed to be, and it lashed out in very hurtful ways. I know the people who lashed out. I've known some of them for years, and they are very good people who care deeply about the inherent worth and dignity of others and devote their lives to creating more goodness and love in the world. They really, for sure, do. I can't overemphasize how much I respect these people who this happened with. In that room, though, implicit bias and fear won the day. And it was incredibly sad. It contradicted all we say we are as UUs. Things like this could happen to any of us when we don't expect it, because our brains on fear and implicit bias are set up to fill in stories in this particular way. Our brain takes little pieces of data and decides how they go together. And when there's a lot of fear in there, that's what happens. When there's implicit bias in there, that fills in. And so when you consider how much fear we all ingest as part of our culture, it's a wonder we don't have more stories like this. Or perhaps we do and we just don't even know them. The journey into fear is so easy. It's faster than a snap. We notice something out of the ordinary, and our bodies are flooded with hormones or neurotransmitters, shutting down reason, increasing our heart rate, focusing attention on ending whatever we think the threat is. We do it even when we don't want to do it. So what do we do? What is the journey out of fear? The journey out is not as easy as the journey in. There are some tools that we can use, however. The first tool is to become a person who is less stressed by fear. The less fear you have in your body and hanging out there, the better it's going to go for you. We are more reactive to fear when we have fear hormones that are built up in our body, when we have more fear memories, when we have more implicit bias associations that are related to fear. And you are not going to like this at all, but exercise turns out to be one of the essential ways of releasing these hormones. Just another thing exercise is good at, right? And when you are in good shape and exercising regularly, those hormones clear out of your bodies more completely. And we actually build, if people are exercising regularly, you actually build neurons in your brain that do not get affected by cortisol quite as easily as other neurons. So that's pretty cool. So friends and community also mitigate our reactions to fear, both biochemically, but also by the support that we get when we're concerned and nervous and afraid, like Ruby Bridges did in the story this morning. And they help us discern the truth. Like, should we be afraid of this thing? Because sometimes, you know, that's really reasonable. And they help us practice courage when it's appropriate to do so. Another tool for journeying out of fear is learning to pause. Well, this is completely inappropriate when a car is swerving into your lane. The pause is an essential tool for dealing with fear. It helps us manage the kind of fear that keeps us being from our most hospitable and compassionate selves. To pause, we need to know what fear feels like, particularly the kind that triggers implicit bias fear. It can feel like a gut response, a lurch in the stomach, or maybe it's heightened suspicion. Perhaps your heart rate goes up, skin tingles, or your mouth goes dry. For me, it settles on my chest, and I feel a fluttering anxiousness. Each of us can learn what our particular response to fear feels like. And pausing means learning to sit with that feeling that happens, and not acting, so that we can make decisions about it. And fear wants us to act, even if it is yelling or just going to the freezer for chocolate ice cream. But it turns out that we don't have to act. We can actually just be with that hormone, neurotransmitter thing that happens to our bodies. We can just hang out with it. It doesn't really settle very easily. There are some tricks to making it settle. One is that meditation on breathing we did. Breathe in peace and breathe out love. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathing deeply, letting your breathing out long, really is helpful in settling things down. The other thing that's really helpful in settling things down is smiling. In fact, smiling is a whole different set of neurotransmitters and hormones that can kind of counteract it. But basically, you're kind of stuck with that feeling once it happens. So the most important thing is that you're having the feelings and you can just sit with them and you learn that fear doesn't get to be in charge. Because when fear is in charge, that's when you do things that maybe later you weren't so happy you did. And then when you're in that pause, you can let your reasoning brain decide if there's danger or not. And sometimes fear is absolutely the most appropriate response. And acting is the appropriate response. Women for years have been taught, you know, when they have that gut reaction, to pause. And then when they move into the in, they're supposed to be polite and kind and not, like, run away or set clear boundaries. So, I mean, there's a lot of trickiness to figuring it out, actually, in your mind at that time. But maybe, you know, somebody just did trigger your implicit bias fear. And then you get to override those feelings and smile genuinely and walk forward and not cross the street. So another strategy for overcoming fear is taking small actions that desensitize you to fear. If you learn through pausing that certain types of people make you nervous, it's probably time to start talking to those types of people. So you let that fear reaction happen because you can't really stop it. And if your reason says okay, then you override it. So you start saying hi to that mumbling homeless woman near the library that you pass every time you go in. And after a while, she's not going to scare you anymore. She's just lonely and sad, and her brain plays a lot more tricks on her than yours does on you. The journey into fear is so easy, and the journey out is hard. Fear protects us. It does. But it can also isolate us and keep us away from those who need us and those who need our diversity and our truth, and who need our diversity, and they can bring diversity and truth into our lives. The journey out of fear is hard, and I hope that we will lean on each other as we take that journey. So here are some closing words for us. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. Frank Herbert.